talk about how we could use fast radio bursts as probes of large-scale structure. So, so this recent transient radio phenomena for cosmology, basically. So my talk actually has two parts. The first is one most related to the title, and that's how fast radio bursts might be used to map large-scale structure in three dimensions. So I'm going to try to convince you that this is a three-dimensional probe, unlike just sort of angular clustering statistics, large-scale structure. And the second half of the talk is sort of much more, it's observational, it's much more astrophysics-y because it's about fast radio bursts in particular. However, this gives us a lot of information about what fast radio bursts are. It doesn't solve any, it doesn't give any definitive answers, but it gives us clues and information. And that, having an understanding of the bursts and their sources is going to be it's going to be essential for using them for cosmology eventually. So despite being two parts, I think the second one is sort of required for the first one to work. So what is a fast radio burst? So fast radio bursts were first detected at the Parkes Telescope, the Parkes Radio Telescope in Australia in 2007. There are now a whole 16 published events, all detected at gigahertz frequencies. They're roughly a millisecond long, and a Jansky, their brightness is a Jansky, or a flux, sorry, is a roughly a Jansky. And they're broadband, so we observe them over the full band of, bandwidth of the instrument. So we've only seen 16, but it's actually estimated there's 5,000 of these things happening a day. And we only see 16 because we haven't looked very long with the time resolution you need to detect them. And also the field of view of a radio telescope is something like a tenth of a square degree. So you just don't see very much of the sky at once, so you have to wait hundreds of hours before you see a single one in current instruments. And one of their defining characteristics is that they're highly dispersed. So what does that mean? That means that when you observe them, they're only a millisecond long, but at each frequency, the lower frequencies are delayed compared to the higher frequencies, so the time of arrival is later, and that can be later by of order seconds, even though they're only a millisecond long. Why is that? So at the time of emission, it's assumed that all frequencies are emitted at the same time. It's just a broadband ping, instantaneous or millisecond long. But as the radio waves travel through the astrophysical plasmas, the long wavelengths get delayed. Their speed of light is slower for the long wavelengths compared to the short wavelengths. And you get this characteristic lambda squared delay in the time of arrival. So dispersion isn't anything new. We observe it in pulsars all the time. And so the amount of, I said that the total delay is proportional to the wavelength squared. The proportionality constant is called the dispersion measure. And that's just a measure of the total number of electrons, the total column of electrons between the source and us, the observers. So since dispersion just counts electrons between us and the source, routinely used for as a distance estimate for pulsars. So if you have a model for the galaxy and where the electrons are in the galaxy, you can use the total number of electrons between you and the source to figure out where in that electron distribution the source was. However, so that works for pulsars. It's routinely used. However, for fast radio bursts are unique in that at the high galactic latitudes we see them. If you just use the model for where the electrons are in the galaxy, you decide that actually the fast radio burst is coming from far outside the galaxy. There just aren't enough electrons along that line of sight to produce the dispersion we see. And in fact, if you assume the dispersion is dominated by the IGM, because the galactic contribution is normally small, so if it's dominated by the intergalactic medium, they're actually at redshift 0.2 or to 1, depending on which of the 16 bursts you're talking about. So they look very much like single pulses from pulsars, except they're coming from halfway across the universe, maybe. So the question to address in the first part is, so let's just say that FRBs are in fact extragalactic and at cosmological distances. And let's assume that with 5,000 or so events a day that we could somehow make a survey with many thousand events. So since they're coming from the universe and everything in the universe is clustered in some way, then these should be clustered in some way. And how would you describe the clustering of these events? So what, how would you, what observational methods would you, what statistics would you use, and what do you expect to measure? So this first half of the talk, this is theoretical work that I did with Chris Sigurdsson at, who was visiting here, I think, just like a month ago or 2 months ago, at UBC. Something like 10 to the 42 ergs, I think. 10 to the 40, 42 ergs. So it's energetically, they're not actually very difficult because they're so short. What's very difficult is the brightness. Because so if you assume, because you have the short millisecond time scale, you have a limit on the physical size of the object, and it puts the brightness at something like 10 to the 30, this might be wrong, but 10 to the 30-ish brightness temperature. Kelvins. So it's the challenge is actually the brightness, not the total energy, because they're very short. So it's less energy than a supernova or a gamma ray burst. So we define this thing called dispersion space. It's analogous to say redshift space for a spectroscopic redshift survey. So dispersion measure, as I said, is the total path integral of the electron density. And if the electrons, if the dispersion is dominated by the IgM, then on very large scales, we expect that to be relatively homogeneous. And with a homogeneous background of electrons, we can just use that dispersion measure as a distance estimate. Right? So the dispersion gives us an estimate of the distance to the source. And that means we can use dispersion and dispersion space surveys to study clustering in 3D, not 2D. Okay, so we're going to go beyond just angular clustering statistics and look at 3D clustering. So that's analogous but completely independent of a spectroscopic redshift survey for a galaxy survey. However, like redshift, dispersion measure is not a perfect proxy for distance, and that's because the electrons are not perfectly homogeneous. There's structure, there's clustering of the electrons as well. And that means that your distance estimate, so I'm going to use chi throughout for the radial co-moving distance. The subscript s means the distance I would measure in dispersion space. So the distance I would measure in dispersion space, the difference between it and its true location in the universe, is just the path integral of the overdensity of electrons. Okay. So if I perturbations in the electron density field give me an error in my distance estimate. Because dispersion space is not the same as real space, we'll have additional clustering terms. These will be the dispersion space distortions, an analogy to the redshift space distortions we see in redshift space that are caused by peculiar velocities relative to the Hubble flow. So now I'm going to talk about, so I've got sort of one longish equation in my talk, but I'm going to go through it term by term, and I really want to emphasize the physics of the terms of this equation. So don't worry too much about just staring at the equation and understanding it. I'm going to go through it piece by piece. So the most part, to get the dispersion space distortions, so the overdensity of fast radio burst sources that I would observe in dispersion space compared to the overdensity of fast radio burst sources that exist in real space. I can't observe real space, but presumably such a density field exists. You can basically just follow the derivation that Nick Kaiser did of the redshift space distortions in 1987. And I'm working entirely to linear order and cosmological perturbations. So to leading order, there are three effects. Okay. So I'm just going to leave the notation there at the bottom just so you can remind yourself quickly if you need to. So the density field that I observe in dispersion space, so that's the overdensity of fast radio burst sources as observed in dispersion space, is just equal to the real density field, right? With these three corrections, and so the first term is a dilution term. So if I have a bunch of fast radio bursts sitting in an overdensity of electrons. Okay, so delta is a positive number, for instance, for this little piece of space. Then in dispersion space, I overestimate the distance between electrons, between fast radio bursts. So I have a burst here, I have a burst here. They're this far apart, but there's extra electrons between them, and so in dispersion space, I stretch. I estimate there's more distance between these sources. So if I have extra distance between the sources, then the electron overdensity is a negative contribution to the observed density. Okay, and so that dilutes the electrons. Extra electrons dilute the fast radio burst sources. So this is the term that's most analogous to the Kaiser redshift space term. However, the Kaiser redshift space distortion term is anisotropic. So in redshift space, only modes that have a radial wave vector can cause radial velocities. And those radial velocities are what bias my distance estimate in redshift space. It doesn't matter what mode causes the overdensity in dispersion space. Any overdensity will cause extra electrons between these my sources and dilute them. So this is a fully isotropic term that doesn't depend on what mode is what the direction of the wave vector of the electrons is. There's a geometric term. So that's simply if I have some estimate for the dispersion space distance and that's not the true distance, then I misinterpret angles on the sky. So an angle, the correspondence between the between an angle and a true proper distance is different if I have a bad distance estimate. So if I misestimate the radial distance, I misestimate angular distances, and that because there's two angles in the sky, you get a factor of two there, and that's just a purely geometric effect. So this effect is in principle present in redshift space. However, in redshift space, it's very small and tends to be ignored. That's because it's radial modes that source the redshift space distortions. There's normally a lot of net cancellation along the line of sight because your perturbation is a Fourier mode along the line of sight, and so the total integral, the total amount of distance error that you make is normally small. Where here it's not, it can be very large. The last term is a source density gradient term. So if I misestimate how far away the fast radio bursts are, then I'm just going to compare it to the wrong background density. So the number of fast radio bursts I observe is some distance of redshift, or some function of redshift, some function of distance away from me. It's just because, you know, as they're further away, it'll get dimmer. I won't see as many of them, or maybe there's some intrinsic evolution into the rate of fast radio bursts as a function of redshift. And so if I compare it to the wrong background, even if there isn't an overdensity or an underdensity, but I just misestimate the distance, I compare it to the wrong background, I just interpret that to be an overdensity or underdensity. So those are the three distinct dispersion space distortion terms. For the most part, I'm going to group those into these local terms, and these terms that depend on the distance, the difference between dispersion space distance and the real distance, I'm going to call the integral term because that's just the integral of the electron overdensity. Okay, so I'll refer to a local term and an integral term throughout the rest of the talk. Just to give you a taste for what this would look like, if you simulate a density field, say a dark matter density field, and you expect it to look something like this with radial distance going up the page. So it's fairly isotropic. Maybe there's some redshift evolution, but you know, so we're sort of used to looking at maps like this as Gaussian random fields. And then in dispersion space, because you have this integral along the line of sight, you get correlations along the line of sight. So the density field here is highly correlated to the density field there because they share some piece of this integral. Notice this coefficient, actually, this thing is always negative for realistic source models, or usually negative. So the coefficient actually changes signs at some redshift, where the contribution of this integral term is actually zero somewhere in the middle. Okay, So now I'm going to show calculations for what we expect to see for two-point statistics, what we expect to actually measure for some toy model. So we don't actually know we don't know anything about fast radio bursts. There's 16 mysterious bursts.
Yeah. This didn't used to be an integral then. So how did it become an integral then?
Oh, sorry. So this. Yeah. This thing, I just two slides ago, I said this thing is just the. It's a substitution. When it's written this way, it's just more easy to see the physics. And when it's written this way, that's how you get to the density fields. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So now we need if we want to sort of hypothesize what we would actually observe, you need a model for half of the fast radio burst cluster. Do you have a question, Kendrick? So we don't actually know anything or very much about fast radio bursts. We assume they cluster in some way because everything in the universe clusters in some way. But we don't know what they are, what kind of galaxies they're coming from, what physical processes they're related to. And so we have no idea how they cluster. So we'll just make something up. So I'm just going to use a linear bias model. So I'm just going to say that the fast radio bursts cluster the same way as the dark matter, but they cluster a little bit more with a coefficient of 1.3. So they're just 1.3 times more clustered than the dark matter. That's the coefficient you would use for something like star-forming galaxies, young star-forming galaxies. So if you thought fast radio bursts were related to supernova or magnetars or some young stellar population, you might expect a bias factor of something like 1.3. But that's just a total guess. Also, you need a model for where the electrons are because what I observe actually depends more on the electrons than it does on the fast radio bursts themselves. So you need a model for how the electrons cluster. But electrons, we don't know very much about where the electrons are. There's this missing baryon problem where if you actually just go out and observe all the baryons you can, and all the electrons, you only get something like half of what you expect from the CMB, so we actually don't know where the electrons are in the universe. However, on very large scales, there's a conservation of free electrons. You can't destroy. Basically, all the electrons are ionized. You can't create or destroy them the way you could create galaxies, not destroy them. I guess you can with mergers. And so, on very large scales, scales larger than the distance an electron can travel over structure evolution, the bias factor has to be 1. And then it can do something funny on small scales, but I'm just going to say it's 1 on all scales. I'm going to use a made-up but reasonable source density function for the fast radio bursts. So where they are is where the fast radio bursts are coming from as a function of redshift. How many of them do we see at each redshift or each radial distance? I'm just going to use something that's consistent with the 16 bursts we see so far. That's not very hard. It puts most of the sources at redshift 0.5. So this thing comes into the what you observe because of the source dense gradient term right here. Okay, so the two-point statistic I want to consider is an angular power spectrum. So the same as CMB, it's an angular power spectrum. So it's on as a function of scale in the sky, how much power do you see? But since this is a 3D tracer, not a 2D tracer, the way the CMB is, I'm going to be cross-correlating two different radial slices. So I take some bin of fixed DM, I count all the sources and make a map. I take another bin at a different DM, I count up all the sources on my map, make two density maps, and cross-correlate them. Okay. So this, if you consider this for all pairs of chi and chi prime, this contains all the information to linear order for a Gaussian field. For the ones I'm going to show, I'm just going to put the two slices near 2,000 H inverse megaparsecs, and I'm actually going to vary how far separated the slices are. So I'm going to start with two very nearly small separated slices, so within a correlation length of the large scale structure, basically. And remember I said there was a local term and integral term, and then in the two-point statistic, there'll also be a cross term. And so I'm going to talk about the three terms. So even at the small radial separation, the integral term basically dominates everywhere. This local term that contains the FRB clustering themselves just barely dominate, or just barely dominates in on a few angular scales. And that's even when I'm talking about two slices that are right next to each other, right? As I go to, and the cross term is very subdominant, although cutely, you can see the baryon acoustic oscillations in it. As I go to more to larger radial separations, the local term drops off fast. So after 20 megaparsecs, the amount of that's bigger than most clustering in the universe. So it's more than a correlation length. So the amount of intrinsic clustering I see, the local term, drops off very quickly. The integral term and the cross term are completely unaffected because those are dominated by this line of sight integral, and they share the line of sight integral has barely changed, right? We've only subtracted 2% off of this line of sight integral. So that's basically unaffected. And then as I go to 50 or 100 megaparsecs, this local term just disappears, and these terms just stick around and they don't do anything. And so basically, the evolution of these two terms is actually dominated just by that coefficient of the integral. So just a note about tomography. So this expression has some similarities to, say, weak lensing, right? Weak lensing is a line of sight integral of the density. The dark matter density, it's actually the potential, so there's some factors of K in there, but the line of sight integral of the density, and so this term shares some characteristics with weak lensing. In weak lensing, we have the concept of tomography. So that is because we have this line of sight integral, and there's an opening angle that probes different angular scales at different radii from us at different distances. The statistic mixes all the angular scales. But you could use tomography, so you can measure all pairs of scales, all pairs of slices, and know that the nearby slices contribute small scale, have the small scale contribution to the far away slices. They share some of the integrand, and you try to use that to back out and to separate scales and back out more information from your observable. So this also permits tomography. In lensing, this integral has a window function. There's a weight function here, and that weight function depends on the limit of integration. And so tomography is inexact. You have to use sort of more complicated inversion techniques to try to back out what this density field is under the integral and separate scales. Whereas here, if I have a contribution at some far radial distance and some near radial distance, I can actually just subtract these two terms and I just get the contribution that comes in between, right? There's no weight function underneath the integrand. So tomography is in principle exact.
Except that you have those
first two. Yeah, you have first two terms, yeah. I mean, and this coefficient changes, but maybe you might think you can model that and know it, right? So I mean, I'm not saying it's easy.
Measure, but the first two, this is how you measure them.
Yeah, but keep in mind, these first two terms, they correlate in the cross term with the further slices, right? And so, yeah. But no, I agree that you have other terms. Yeah, you don't just get to subtract them. You do still have to do some inversion, but it's less uncertain than lensing.
I mean, the principle is magnification bias, right? Whose coefficient depends on the velocity function of the FRB. Well, I guess assuming that you have your FRB sample is defined by a minimum flux or some selection function of flux, then if I look through a gravitationally lensed, well, just in Gauss's case, there are two effects. If I had a fixed population of FRBs, then if I look along a magnified line of sight, that makes the apparent density less. Mm-hmm. Then for a flux limit sample, it changes the surface brightness so that you can move objects in and out of the
right. Right.
So now, in the Gaussian case, that term is smaller than the minimum clustering term, and that's also probably the case here.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're relying on, there is some subdominant term being neglected here, which would make the tomography slightly ineffective.
Right. No, that's cute. I like that. yeah. Yeah. It's. I mean, there's. Sorry. So I should use a disclaimer. There's several systematic effects that we have thought of, and probably several that we haven't. So if you want sort of a detailed inventory of the things that could ruin this, by all means, go look at our paper. But I'll actually talk about the thing that I worry about the most, just coming in two slides. So let's say a note on detectability. So how many bursts would you need to measure something? So I told you that all the information is in, you have to measure all pairs of these angular power spectrum. If I collapse that to just one, so I'm going to put angular brackets over there, just to say I've done some signal to noise average of all these pairs of radial slices, to collapse this to one power spectrum, and I ask how well could I measure that one power spectrum? And the answer is with 10,000 events, so 2 days worth of a full sky survey, but you know more like many, many, many days of an actual survey. with 10,000 events, you actually get to measure the shape of the angular power spectrum really well. So you have a many, many, many sigma detection, and you get the shape of this angular power spectrum. So that would be a fairly sensitive experiment. Note that because the integral term dominates for the vast majority of angular pairs, so all the ones that are separated by more than 5 megaparsecs, and the integral term is basically never big, that actually you're completely insensitive to the fast radial burst clustering itself. The only thing you're measuring is some radial integral of the some windowing of the electron power spectrum. So these are two different fast radial burst bias models, and the lines basically lie right on top of each other. They're not different. So it's the electrons that you're really measuring.
I can jump in with a comment here. I just want to comment that this number 10,000 is in the ballpark of what we.
Yeah, that's my last slide. I was saving that for like this. Yeah, no, I was saving that for like, yeah, we can do this. Like, no, you're like, spoiler alert. Yeah, dramatic effect, Kendrick, dramatic effect. So what are the applications to this? So the integral term gives us actually a full measurement, could give us a full measurement of the electron power spectrum on large scales, right? So that just solves the missing baryon problem, I think. So I think that's one application of this. With 5,000 per sky per day, you might not think that you don't actually have to stop at 10,000. You could stop at 10 million eventually. And then, you know, large scale structure, BAO, like, you could imagine there are versions of the future where it's easier to get 10 million of these than it is to get 10, well, probably not 10 million spectra, but maybe if you went up to like 100 million spectra. I mean, we're going to get 10 million spectroscopic galaxies sort of in 5 years, but you could conceive that this might be easier. I'm not saying it is. There's no surveys that could even planned yet that would get to say 10 million or even a million of these, but you could imagine. And so you could think of doing large scale structure, BAO, everything that we do with currently do with galaxy surveys. Also, this 5,000 number—that's a very limited. That's what we observe in a very limited a space of brightnesses and spectral indices. So, if the spectrum is very red, there's a lot of low frequency instruments coming up. So, I'm talking about the spectra, the brightness spectra of the actual individual bursts. If they're very red, or if there are a lot of dim events and we build bigger telescopes, then maybe we can bump this 5,000 number up using dimmer events. But that's sort of unconstrained. No one really knows. So there's a catch. And that catch is we have no idea what fast radial burst sources are. Well, we have an idea, but we don't actually know. And in particular, the thing that's most worrying is that we don't actually know what portion of the dispersion is from the intergalactic medium. So we've just been assuming that the IGM is dominating the dispersion, thus gives us the distance measurement. If there's a source local contribution, something coming from the host galaxy or from the source itself, and if that portion is large and variable, then we don't have a distance estimate anymore, right? You just have this unknown contaminant of every distance measurement you make, and this becomes a not very useful technique. At least as a 3D probe, maybe you can still use it as a 2D probe. You can imagine that these things might not even be cosmological at all. They serve, I think we were convinced they're extragalactic, but maybe they're like 100 megaparsecs away in some very, very dense region and get all their dispersion right at the source and then come to us from local structure, right? And that would be very unfortunate. There's models of fast radio bursts where fast radio bursts are super giant pulses from pulsars in the near in the local universe, and that's not a large scale structure probe. So we really need to actually understand the sources in order to know that this would work, or to have a chance to work. So that brings me to the second part of my talk, and so I'm going to talk about real data work that was done by the hydrogen intensity mapping team at Green Bank Telescope, which I'm part of. That detected a fast radio burst and used it to gain a better understanding of what these sources are.
Can I just pick up the one question? If you're switching away from the
Sure. Actually, I should take questions for that for sure right now.
Have you thought about cross correlations
with other We've thought about them we've definitely said the words cross correlating with lensing, especially because you have that integral term. Have we actually done a calculation? We've definitely thought about it. I don't know if we've ever actually written it.
You need fewer objects because you use the certain exponent has high signal noise per mode.
Yeah.
So you'd be paying one power of the FRB signal noise instead of two.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. I think cross correlations. So if we never figure out what FRB sources are, then we can still figure out where they are from the cross correlations even. I think that's probably even more promising for disentangling all these three different terms, especially, right?
Yeah. I mean, your results show that you might those cross correlations are a little more subtle to interpret than you might think. You might think, oh, if I cross correlate an FRB sample with galaxy density at redshift 0.5, I've proven that the FRBs come from that redshift. But you show that the integral term actually dominates
right.
The power and clustering power.
Yeah, so they could be way further away, actually.
Yeah, they could be at 0.5 or higher.
Yeah.
We need to do a little decomposition.
Yeah. Okay, so the FRB is FRB 110523, so that's when it, 2011, May 23rd is when it occurred. We didn't find it then, it just sat on disk for 4 years. So it was discovered, as I mentioned, in the Green Bank Telescope hydrogen intensity mapping data. So that is a large scale structure survey that's attempting to do hydrogen intensity mapping. It was detected from 700 to 900 megahertz. This is the first FRB that's been detected outside the 1.4 gigahertz band. So all the other 15 have been in what's called L band. Its dispersion measure is 623 parsecs per centimeter cubed. That's just a number, but it means redshift 0.5 if the intergalactic medium dominates the dispersion. So we get a very precise measurement of this lambda. This delay is equal to is proportional to lambda squared.
We can I ask a question? So the integral of the spectrum measures inside the plane of the galaxy, like if you're looking at
yeah.
What is it?
In the galactic center, it's like 1,000. But along this line of sight, at high galactic latitude, it's like 20. So the dispersion measures are as high as the very highest pulsars coming from right in the galactic plane in the other side of the galaxy. And then for if the second you go even 3 degrees off the galactic plane, it just drops to tens. So we measure this lambda squared dispersion relations, delay is proportional to lambda squared, to 3 decimal places. So that's very easy to measure because you just have the width, which is a millisecond, the total delay, which is 2.5 seconds. So I get a very high precision measurement. This actually gives us an upper limit of the plasma frequency of the dispersing electrons. And thus it gives us an upper limit on the density of the dispersing electrons. So the electrons can't be denser than a certain number, which is a lower limit on the size of the dispersing region. That limit is 10 astronomical units. So that's not normally astrophysically interesting, but it does entirely rule out any atmospheric source model, which was a concern for a while. I think the field is, even before this measurement, has settled that they're not terrestrial or atmospheric. But you know, this sort of puts the nail in the coffin of that one. But it also rules out all the remaining viable galactic source models. So the only way that you could be in the galaxy was if it was, there was a small compact cloud of electrons. The proposal was a flare star that was putting out these fast radio bursts, and that there was some stellar wind that was causing the dispersion. Stellar corona. But that corona would be presumably much, much smaller than 10 AU, so that completely rules out that model. The advocates of that model, of course, disagree, we're pretty convinced. So this puts it on very firm grounds that these are extragalactic events. So I've shown you in frequency time space. If I go to if I collapse the frequency and just show you what it looks like as a function of time, see, it's 44% linearly polarized. This is the first detection of linear polarization in a fast radio burst. So the vast majority of fast radio bursts just didn't record polarization. The community was normally observes pulsars, and they, when they're searching for pulsars, they just do total intensity. You want to save the factor of 4 in disk space, and they always know that they can go back and observe it later to get polarization. That doesn't work for fast radio bursts, we're one of the first to even record polarization. We are the first to get to measure linear polarization.
Separation of the U and U Stokes parameters after fitting out that rotation.
Yeah. So I'm showing the slides in a different order than they are in the paper, just because it just sort of follows a little bit better the logic. But that's the next slide, the one after. So we see the linear polarization, but we also see that angle rotates during the 3 or 4 milliseconds of the pulse. Okay. If you combine that with a recent measurement, one that was released in December, of a 2-component pulse, so this is not our fast radio burst, this is a different one, but it has 2 distinct peaks. So I think this is starting to give us clues about the source emission mechanism. I don't think it tells us any definitive answers, the authors of this paper say that a catastrophic sort of a collision of 2 neutron stars or anything that's catastrophically destroying the sources can't produce a two pulse burst. I don't think that's actually true, right? I mean, these pulses are only separated by 10 milliseconds. If it could easily take more than 10 milliseconds to destroy the source. These are at least something. We're getting substructure. The point is we're getting substructure to these pulses, so we're getting hints of the emission mechanism. I'm not going to speculate on what models are inconsistent with this. This is naturally explained by pulsar supergiant pulses, because we see this all the time as pulsar supergiant pulses in the galaxy.
So do you interpret that rotation as the Faraday rotation or magnetic field?
No. The Faraday rotation would be as a function of frequency. This is a function of time over a very short time scale. This rotation is frequency independent. We do see Faraday rotation, that's the next slide, but that rotates the whole pulse, all 5 milliseconds of it uniformly as a function of frequency. Faraday rotation, yay. Okay, so I said we have linear polarization. So this is Stokes Q and Stokes U. And the spectra that we see actually have this sinusoidal structure with it's actually sinusoidal in lambda squared, which is a signature of Faraday rotation. That's a measurement of the magnetic field along the line of sight. So if there's a magnetic field along the line of sight and there's electrons in the same place, then that will rotate the polarization vector as a function of frequency. And so that gives us a rotation measure of 186 radians per meter squared. So what does that mean? So if you take the rotation measure and the dispersion measure together, so the rotation measure tells us the electron-weighted line of sight magnetic field, and the dispersion measure just tells us the whole total number of electrons. So if you take that together, we can get a measure of the magnetic field But using electron weighting. That electron weighting is probably not it's not representative of the actual magnetic field. However, if it was representative of the actual magnetic field, you'd expect 10 micrograus, because that's the magnetic field in galaxies, the large-scale coherent magnetic field in galaxies. So if the dispersion were all happening at the source, then you'd expect an electron-weighted magnetic field of roughly 10 micrograus. Now, there's many ways out of this. You can have cancellations along the line of sight. You can have magnetic fields oriented this way and then that way. You can also have just, you know, you could be looking through the plane of the galaxy and the magnetic field is perpendicular to that. So this is a hint. This doesn't tell us that the dispersion is not happening in the source, but it is a hint that it might be not be happening in the source. Yes?
But then wouldn't you expect similar contributions from the Milky Way
So none of the dispersion is happening. So there's electron weighting. So there's none of the dispersion is happening in the Milky Way, like something like a few percent of it, right? And so the contribution of the Milky Way to the Faraday rotation is entirely negligible. The Faraday rotation in this and along this direction, I think, is like 8, whereas we observe 186. So it's a very tiny contribution. And then the ionosphere gives another 1 or 2. So if you just ask, if in a normal spiral galaxy, how many lines of sight have a rotation measure this high? And the answer is not many of them, but not none of them. You know, 10% or so, right? So it's marginally high for a generic line of sight. So maybe we're in a special place. Maybe in the galaxy, but it's not like, you know, if I just ask out of Milky Way, what's the rotation measure to some random source, 20%, 10% chance I'll get something of order this size. So the thing that was most exciting about this burst is the scintillation and scattering. So the electrons, they have a refractive index. That's what causes the dispersion delay. That refractive index is a strong function of frequency. And so if there's inhomogeneities in those electrons, that's a lens, right? And so this burst will. So in general, fast radio transients they are lensed by plasma inhomogeneities. If the delays associated with that lens are short, then you get what's called scintillation. So that's a coherent interference of the multiple paths against each other, causing fluctuations in the brightness as a function of frequency. So you see a bright spot here, a bright spot there. There's basically no flux coming there and there and there. And you see that over the whole band. So that's scintillation. That's just interference of the burst with itself going through multipath propagation through this lens. If the delays are longer than the burst itself, say milliseconds, then it's actually just the total delay through that lens that matters, and you get this characteristic exponential scattering tail. You just get later copies of the burst arriving, and you get a scattering tail. So we actually observe both of them. Both of these are expected to be frequency dependent because, yep.
Curve, sandwiching a bright curve.
Yeah, it's to guide the eye. That's just 1/lambda² to guide the eye. Yeah, so that's just sort of the standard way they're plotted these days. You just draw some lines along the burst just to highlight where the burst is. So a lot of these, this one's fairly bright. A lot of these are detected with signal noise of 10 after collapsing over the whole band. And so you really have to squint at plots like this in order to be able to see them. And so you have to draw these lines on. This one, it's kind of okay without it. But you still want to see, just by eye, how close it is to the lambda-squared dispersion relation. I think the field will probably get away from plotting these just because every burst has been perfectly lambda-squared so far. So it's no longer something we need to establish. So we do see both scintillation, so the coherence, the spectral coherence decorrelation width of these sentils, these spots, is about a megahertz. So that's indicating that there's microsecond delays associated with that lens. Here we see a millisecond scattering tail that's detected at high significance. And we also detect the frequency dependence of that scattering tail at mediocre significance. It's saying that there's milliseconds delays associated with this burst as well. And so these are two far separated timescales. There's two lenses, actually, two completely distinct lenses lensing this burst. So we can actually use this to learn about these lenses and the interplay between these two screens to figure some stuff out. Oh, okay. I'm meeting with someone immediately after this talk.
Can I start talking now?
Where are you, keynote? There we go. Thank you. Sorry. So we actually know that the microsecond delays, the short time scale, that's actually from a galactic screen. We know that because there's a pulsar two degrees from our source that has the identical scintillation, has the identical microsecond delays. That pulsar is 3 kiloparsecs away. So that puts the source of the microsecond delays between us and that pulsar, less than 3 kiloparsecs. We're going to use a distance of roughly 1 kiloparsec. We're not too sensitive to what we actually put in there. But we're going to use 1 kiloparsec because that's the scale height of the galactic disk. Okay, so it's just galactic disky electrons that are causing that and turbulence in them that are causing those microsecond delays. So we have a distance to the screen, and we have a time scale associated with the delays of the screen. We actually know the angular size of the screen and the physical size of the screen. Okay, so we have a lens. So this screen is a lens in the sky, and we know how big that lens is. Okay. Now it turns out that things only scintillate if they're unresolved by the lens. Okay, so the way to an analogy is that if so we've all observed scintillation in the atmosphere with stars. So if you look at a star, it twinkles. And it actually, if you look really closely at a certain star, you actually see it change color as it twinkles. All right? And that's just turbulence in the atmosphere that's scintillating. You get these little images that interfere with each other, and you get twinkling. Turns out planets don't twinkle. Right? Planets don't twinkle because they are resolved by the lens. You have many independent point sources. So you can think of a planet as being made up of many independent point sources. Each of these point sources are interfering with themselves, but they don't interfere with each other because they're decoherent with each other. And so you have a statistical cancellation, and you get no net twinkling of planets. So same thing happens here. If this screen, if the image that this thing that's being scintillated, which is the first screen, that was resolved by the second screen, the near screen, then we wouldn't see any scintillation at all. So the fact that we even observe scintillation with this screen that's that big gives us a limit on the angular size of this screen. And since we also have a limit on the radial distance from the dispersion measure, it's only an upper limit because there might be some source local contribution. So since we also have a limit on this distance, we have a limit on the physical size of the screen. And we also have a time delay associated with this lens. Right, and so that's two sides of a triangle. I can invert that to figure out, to have a limit on how far away this screen is from the source. And it's less than 40 kiloparsecs. This screen is inside the host galaxy. It is not the IGM, turbulence in the IGM. It's not some halos along the line of sight. This screen is right in the host galaxy. Turns out that it's hard, in a generic galaxy, it's hard to get a full millisecond of scattering. There's only two real things. So we observe scattering in pulsars as well in our own galaxy. There's only two things that could give us a full millisecond of scattering. That would be a source local nebula of some sort, or if the source was in the central region of its host. So pulsars are near the center of the Milky Way. They have this much scattering, but ones that aren't don't. Okay, so that's telling us that the source of this fast radio burst. We don't know what its host galaxy is, but we know that's either near the center or in some special region, say a star-forming region or supernova remnant. points to a young stellar population. Right, so both those young stellar populations are sort of expected to exist in both those locations.
Where does the 40 kilo, how does the first 40 kiloparsec give you source local nebula?
It doesn't. It's just that just constrains it to the galaxy, and then you just ask, how do you get in one galaxy? How do you get 1 millisecond of scattering? And the answer is you have to the disk can't do it. There's just not enough scattering from the disk, especially if that disk is an edge-on. If it was directly edge-on, you might be okay, but then you have to be very close to edge-on. But for a generic orientation,
but you can get it from a supernova remnant.
Yeah, you can get from a supernova remnant. You can get it from I think it has to be fairly young, but I double check that. You can get it from near the galactic center.
And what is the quantity after? Because it's like line of sight of electrons, or is it?
Oh no, it has to do with depends on the amount of it's the electrons, density, the turbulence depends on how turbulent it is. There's not 1-to-1 with just the amount of electrons. It's a complicated function.
Velocity going there, or?
So that's a little bit more astrophysics than I'm super versed in, but yeah, there's a lot of it's a complicated process that, so it's a much more an empirical, it's an empirical measure. It's empirically known that it's hard to get from the disk. And that's all coming from the measurements in the Milky Way, right? So we don't observe scattering in other galaxies except for a fast radio burst, which we don't know where they are. So that's a very astrophysics-y empirical statement. So as you were alluding to with the amount of electrons, so this does tell us about something about the region. It still doesn't tell us any very much. I mean, it tells us there is material there. There are electrons there that are causing the scattering. Doesn't tell us the line of sight integral. Doesn't tell us very much about the dispersion. Has to be some contribution because there's definitely some electrons, but you know, it could be, I think it should still be 10, it could still be 100, it could still be higher. It's too complicated for us to back that piece of information out from the scattering. So we'll learn more by replicating these observations to a larger sample. We've learned more from this fast radio burst than any of the previous fast radio bursts. So if we get, say, hundreds of fast radio bursts that all have this depth of knowledge, this wealth of information, then for one thing, we'll just see if these properties are generic or if we just happen to catch a special one. That's an important statement. But also just understanding the statistics of these will give us more information. But what would really help is actually just knowing where they are, what redshift they're at. And for that, we need a host galaxy, right? So we can get a spectroscopic redshift of the host. And any given beam, so if in the Parkes beam or the GBT beam, there's hundreds of galaxies, okay, at a variety of redshifts. So we have no idea what redshift what galaxy that's coming from, and what redshift. So we'd love to get a host galaxy. There's a couple ways you could do that. You could go for an interferometric detection, so you could just use an interferometer and wait for fast radio bursts, and then once you get one, cross-correlate and get the and get the location. You could also hope to get an afterglow. This is how we got the redshifts of GRBs. We actually didn't know GRBs were extragalactic until we had I think it was originally an X-ray afterglow. So if we got an afterglow and then could do interferometry on that to get its location, then we'd then we'd be able to get a redshift.
Have you got an afterglow of say a magnetar fault?
Sorry, what's that?
People try to get afterglows,
so
studied for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So how much have you gotten there?
I don't know, actually. That's a very good question. Presumably people have looked for them. They must have. I don't know how much material is ejected during a magnetar starquake.
Have you gotten your hands on this data? Repeating?
I don't have the data for that, no. Okay, and then just to to go over what Kendrick spoiled for me. The Chaim Telescope in BC, which has steel in the ground, you know, the telescope's all there. Unfortunately, there isn't a single instrument on it. There's no antenna and no computer back end. But the telescope itself exists and should start looking for fast radio bursts in year timescales, maybe a bit less, maybe a bit more. And it will see 10 of these a day. Okay? So so it's going to look, instead of with one beam, so it's the same amount of collecting area as GBT, but it will form sort of order thousands of beams and search each one in real time for fast radio bursts and should find 10 a day. And so that will, I think, by that time, with that, we'll know much, much more about these sources. Probably just sort of, well, I don't want to say probably. There's a decent chance we'll just solve the whole mystery with that telescope. Actually, 10 a day in 3 years, that's 10,000 events. That's enough for a large-scale structure detection if the dispersion measure is dominated by the intergalactic medium. So that's the conclusion of my talk, and I'm happy to take questions.
Do you have a favorite candidate?
Yeah, so I like, as Lewis was alluding to, I like the magnetar flares. So we in the galaxy we've seen these flares from soft gamma ray repeaters from magnetars that are associated with disruptions of the crust, star quakes on the magnetar, and those are easily energetic enough to produce these. We've only ever been observed in gamma rays. The rise time of those gamma rays is order milliseconds, so they're fast enough. The question is, would there be a radio counterpart? We never have the opportunity to see a radio counterpart in the galactic ones.
Galactic origin
most? No, so we see these galactic, but even if they're at redshift 1, there's still enough, more than enough energy to see them in the radio. So there's the energy requirement is not very hard for the fast radio bursts. They're not energetic events, they're bright events. It's how fast the energy is released. And so there's also, I mean, people have done a lot of work on this. There's a couple ways that that people have proposed converting these gamma rays to radio. I think it's a very nice model. I also like that model because it allows them to be extragalactic and allows the first half of this talk to be relevant. The other likely candidate is just supergiant pulses from pulsars, and those are probably not as far away. They'd have to be very young pulsars sitting in like a young supernova remnant. A very young supernova remnant to get all that dispersion just from the source, but it's entirely possible. And then they'd be like 100 megaparsecs away in the local universe, and just interesting, but not from a cosmology point of view.
Why does it matter how old they are to get the dispersion?
Oh, just because the supernova remnant's expanding, and so the column is decreasing as it expands.
Does it?
Well, it's because you're spreading it over less angular.
Change use time by some probably a fixed slope or something. So, well, the two sources you like, you said earlier, will they match that particular observation?
Yeah, so I think both of them are probably fine. Magnetars, so in pulsars, the polarization angle is associated with the rotation of the pulsar, and you get a different projection of the magnetic field as the pulsar is rotating. So, I mean, pulsar supergiant pulses, it's just totally natural. You just 100% expected. If you didn't see it, you'd actually rule them out. If you didn't see it in, let's say you had 100 such measurements and didn't see it in one of them, you just say, okay, it's not pulsars, because the polarization angle has to rotate. And magnetars, they spin as well, right? And the emission mechanism isn't. I mean, everything. So it's a millisecond. The duration is a millisecond, right? That means the source can't be bigger than 100 kilometers. Just the light time, the light crossing time. So if the source is smaller than 100 kilometers, there's nothing in astrophysics that doesn't spin when you bring all that material from far away into 100 kilometers. So everything is going to spin. whether a particular emission mechanism allows that rotation depends on, is model dependent.
You know, if people have an estimate of the rate of Monte Carlos for galaxy per square.
Yeah, I think
consistent with the expectation.
Yeah, and I think it's sort of poorly. You have to decide: is it beamed? Is it not beamed? But I think basically any way you cut it, it's consistent. It's no problem. Things like neutron star mergers you could imagine that there are that many neutron star mergers, but it'd be hard.
Well, I think the most optimistic models of binary mergers for even stars are thought that the orders might be low.
My understanding was that you can imagine that such things. So it depends on how you compare it.
This is the question we're chatting with Chatham. Have they done that? Well, if you had a rate that is consistent with the FRB, so binary neutron star mergers, LIGO was just on the verge of saying it did the intermediate map.
Okay.
And they ran for a couple more rounds. They could have ruled it out.
Right. So a LIGO. Yeah. I mean, LIGO would definitely expect to. I'm just thinking from the rate of. I think the constraints I saw published, which might have been before LIGO's last run, were just based on the rate of gamma ray bursts and how much we think they're beamed. And I think that was just only marginally inconsistent. It wasn't terrible. But as you say, so you brought up the repeating pulse, not me. But the repeating pulse is completely, that thing repeats years later. It's still repeating, right? So that can't be a neutron star merger.
That was really my question. I mean, do the magnetar star quakes, are they expected to repeat with some frequency, or?
I mean. We've seen how many magnetar flares have we seen? Like not even half a dozen, right? Yeah. So we know we've never seen one repeat of the half dozen, but we have more fast radio bursts than we have magnetar star quakes in the galaxy. So you have to make a model to do that, but I don't think it's observationally constrained.
See with LSST or something that's looking for variable sources?
Yeah, I don't know. So that's a very good question for, I don't know what we've seen in the gamma rays, in the galactic ones. I don't know the astrophysics of the details of the magnetars well enough to know that. I don't think we've had, in the galactic ones, I don't think we've had an opportunity just because they happen so fast. But. Avery?
For the dispersion measures for galactic, the gamma ray flares from magnetars.
Yeah, so magnetars are often in star-forming regions, right? They're actually usually in star-forming regions, what's the estimate? I saw one estimate that was quite high. It could be, they said, anywhere between. So some magnetars certainly have dispersion measure of 400, even though for where they are in the galaxy, you just don't expect it to be that high. That's just because of the local star forming region. But there's examples that are quite a bit lower than that too. I don't know the exact number.
Okay,
what's that? Yeah, of order hundreds.
From the local environment.
Absolutely, yeah. The assumption that the IGM dominates the dispersion is a big if, and it's a big if in all the models. I think for pulsars, for pulsar supergiant pulses, it just kills the proposal. For magnetars, it's a maybe. There's always the possibility it's something I haven't thought of. And that's actually a very good possibility.
Thank you again for bringing us some help.